Well, it has been a busy 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Of course. Obviously, there's been a lot going on in our political landscape, which we're not going to get into, of course, but it has been pretty consuming for me.
Yeah.
So I made the decision to quit Facebook.
No. Yeah, did you actually make it, or is this like an ethereal decision? Like,
No.
At some point, I'm quitting.
I had Chandler change the password,
nice.
So I can't change it back.
All right.
So he's handling that, and they're handling my messenger,
yeah.
You know, and everything. And I told him to tell people, you know, obviously that it's not me.
Yeah.
But that's going to save me hours a day from debating or discussing things.
Yeah. How are you feeling about it? Are you still in the pink cloud where it seems like a good idea? No withdrawals yet?
No, there's been some withdrawals.
Yeah.
You know, but I do feel better about it. I have actually been more productive,
mm-hmm.
much more productive. And I feel more at peace, you know, and it's unfortunate that I feel that way because, you know, the discourse in our society over politics has become so rancid, you know.
It's quite a thing. I try to stay out of it.
Yeah, and a lot of people do try to stay out of it, you know, but it's sad because if you kind of care, right, it doesn't matter what side you're on, if you care about these things, it would be nice if we could discuss them without the vitriol, you
know.
But, you know, that's the way it is. So it's, I feel like it's one of those growing things that it's like a society has to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing about it is that I'm a little bit of a historian, and the vitriol has always been there, you know?
Yeah.
So if you go back into history, you know, it's they were just much more eloquent about it, but the way that they used to be able to throw shade at each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eloquently.
A little Shakespeare shade. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Scott Hess, tax and business consultant.
I'm John Barton, small business owner. Remember the tortoise and the hare? Slow and steady wins the race.
We started Turtlesmith to help people start small businesses, providing information and resources to small business owners and entrepreneurs.
Build a solid foundation and forge your dreams.
Should we get into our first segment of this week?
Yeah, lay it on.
We are approaching the end of phase one, the planning. And so our next couple steps are going to be like financial planning and then putting together the actual full business plan. But we got one more step before that, and that is to develop our marketing and our advertising plan. And so the end goal of this is to develop a strategy to get customers and put together your advertising budget. And I like to make people do this before they do the rest of the financial planning, because advertising is usually one of those things that kind of gets pushed to the side when you're thinking about all the other things you have to buy, and you can't skimp on the advertising. This step, it comes in kind of three stages. So the first thing we talk about is what your overall marketing strategy, and marketing and advertising are sometimes used kind of interchangeably, but they're different technically in their definition. So think of the marketing portion as kind of your overall big picture strategy, and then the advertising is the narrow approach of actually targeting customers. So in the marketing strategy, we kind of already identified our target demographic and geographic location in a previous step. And then we've already done our brand development. So now it's just sort of time to put that all together and really think about what our company is trying to say in our advertising and how we're trying to make customers feel when they buy our product. And then one thing that often gets overlooked is customer education. So if you kind of have a new product, or something different, you know, or you differentiated yourself in a different way between your customers, you might have to educate your customers on what it is, you know, how it works. There's a lot of great products out there that seemed ridiculous, but they were great, but nobody knew how to use them, and so they didn't work. You find you have to do a lot of customer education when you first started with your new cases?
Yes, because And that has been, I want to say, the cornerstone of my approach.
Yeah. And you developed quite a few videos showing like how your case works and all the interiors and stuff like that as well, right?
Right. From early on, you know, from the beginning of when YouTube came out and everything that I could access it, I always looked at that as a really good way to do what is called, I guess, guerrilla marketing in a way. Mm-hmm. That was a book that I read a long time ago. They've since had, you know, probably 18, 19 versions of it come out. But essentially, guerrilla marketing means to, if you're on a tight budget, then look for ways that you can communicate your purpose and your the solutions that you bring to the table as often as possible. And, you know, that could be flyers, you know, that could be videos, that could be, back then they would say, you know, the late night TV, you know, you could you could literally get
infomercial 15, spots.
20 minutes. Well, yeah, you could get kind of infomercial spots, mm-hmm. but you could get like 15, 20 minutes sometimes for a couple $100s.
Yeah.
Cause they're trying to fill airtime at that time.
Yeah, the late night hours.
Yeah. And that's exactly why infomercials work so well. Mm-hmm. You know, because you've got enough time to really talk to people and pitch them in a deeper way and a much more nuanced way than you can get to in 30 seconds.
Fair enough. Yeah. Well, the customer education, you got to have some kind of way to tell your customers how your product works, how to use it. And this is also a really good step to think about, is my product maybe too complicated or will people get it? So if you can't eloquently, you know, explain it in an easy way for people to get right away, they're probably going to ignore your product. So it's important to think about that. The other kind of questions we answer in the marketing strategy is, you know, what does my business say to the world? What kind of face are we putting on? And most importantly, how do we want to speak or interact with our customers? So now is a really good time to establish or add on to your training manual a little bit about how you want to interact, what the, you know, script is when you're selling, what is said to customers if they have complaints, things like that. So that's sort of the overall marketing strategy. And we'll have a lot more resources as well to put that together. The next portion of this is the sales approach. So you need to decide, you know, what kind of sales tactics or approach or how you're going to elevator pitch is going to be lined up to attract customers. So there's a handful of different approaches and there's books written on all of them. So feel free to read a lot. But a couple examples are, you know, the soft approach where you're kind of really just offering guidance and getting to know people as you talk to them, you know, mentioning what you do, but not really giving them a hard sell. You just want to inform them of who you are and what you're capable of. And, you know, if they need you or if they maybe need your product, great. The hard approach, you know, high pressure sales tactics, you know, car dealerships, timeshares, those things work, but customers really hate them. So you need to be careful in your hard approach.
Yeah. People definitely resent buying something that turns out to be nowhere near as good as what was promised.
Yeah. And well, we always talk about the overpromising, underdelivering. You never mm-hmm. want to do that. So,
but that's what they get from like the timeshares and mm-hmm. things like that. You know, it's it is really like a whatever the big print promises you, the little print takes away.
I don't know if I've ever seen a timeshare work properly for anyone. So I just avoid those at all costs. Do not buy a timeshare. It's ridiculous.
You know, and the interesting part is now there's an industry that is based on getting people out of timeshare
right.
contracts. I have one of my customers at the pool room. That's how he makes his money.
We've tried to tackle it a few times here for some of our clients, and I've never been able to figure it out. So we usually refer that to other people. So another kind of approach that you can take is one that I do. It's called the consultative selling approach. So when clients come into my office, I really don't pitch them on anything directly. I just listen to their needs, and we usually try to tailor our services around what they need. And so I have various packages and stuff that are kind of standard, but mostly we try to do exactly what the client needs. And that works for my business. It doesn't work for all businesses, especially if you're selling a product, you know, it doesn't work at all. The next one is a solution selling technique. And that's sort of what we talked about you doing. Your product provided a solution. And so that's where you kind of market all of your advertising and strategies towards, is showing people why your product is better because it solves a real problem. And a lot of products or companies do that as well. So we'll have a few more different sales approaches. And then, of course, there's lots of literature out there on you know, that people for people that know from people that know more than us. I'm not the best sales guy in the world, but you got to kind of pick your approach. And then the last portion of this is advertising. And advertising is that direct and narrow focus that we talked about. Depending on what business you're in and how many customers you need to attract will kind of depend on where you should spend your time and most importantly, your money in advertising. So for my business as an accountant, the first thing I did was cold calls, and they're the worst thing that you can possibly do. For most businesses, cold calls really work. And even if you're selling a product, cold calling to distributors and wholesalers and stuff like that is really invaluable. It's hard, and there's, you know, no easy way to go about it. You just have to pick up the phone, get in front of people, and pitch them, you know.
It is hard, and that is one of the things I've always struggled with. Is I like to make a pool cue case. Mm-hmm. I do not like to sell a pool cue case.
Yeah.
Like, there's a part of me that feels like what I do is art, you know? Even though it's a practical solution and it's actually a protective thing, right? It's solving a problem, in my opinion, is protecting a fragile instrument while it's being transported.
Well, yeah, that's one of those problems that you don't have until you have it, and then it's
off. Exactly. That was the thing, yeah. Right? So with me, the case that I had prior to the one that didn't work the way I wanted was the wedge case, right? Mm. But then I got a nicer, cooler case, right? A leather case, a pretty one, you know, one that made me feel like a pool player, like a better pool player, more expensive.
But it didn't have the inversion
part. It didn't have it didn't hold the cue inside, yeah. And as it happened, my case got knocked off of a pool table. The cue literally shot out of it and hit the leg of another table and broke a part of my cue.
Yeah.
And it was a $1,200 cue. So for me back then, you know, I was a young man in the Air Force when I bought the cue, and it literally represented almost 3 months of savings of my pay to be able to get the cue. And so I was pretty disappointed, yep. You know? So what I'm saying is that I rebuilt that interior. And then when I ended up going to a show, now this was, you know, from the first time I rebuilt the interior to say almost a year later, that's when I went to the show.
Yeah.
I had to figure out a way with virtually no money, how to make an impression on the people visiting the show. And that's what I came up with, you know,
that's
so it
that
pays
was your advertising.
Yeah, it pays to be creative and think about how you can get your message across to people in a way that is honest and it works. That's why the infomercials work. You know, they're showing you a product and they're saying this thing will vacuum up nails and, you know, alligators and whatever.
I wonder what the numbers are on infomercials today. I don't know if they work that well with everybody doing Netflix and everything like that anymore, but.
Well, I would say that the successor to the infomercials is basically shorter forms of that show what a product does.
Yeah, on like YouTube and stuff.
Yeah, but I would also say that has led to a lot of fraud as well, because there's a lot of times when a lot of the infomercials, I believe, they were pretty much doing it live.
Yeah.
And the product actually had to work. So it was a way for inventors to get their products out to the public and be noticed. But nowadays, it's a way for people who are fraudsters to misrepresent what the product can actually do. So that cuts against the product. And their idea is to just sell as many as they can until they're found out. And then, of course, they disappear and they move on to the next thing.
Well, there you go. Well, circling back to the cold calls, it's pretty imperative that you're getting in front of customers. And one of the things that you'll likely run into is what we like to call the gatekeeper. And most businesses, particularly if you're selling business to business or if you're selling to a distributor, they usually have some type of administrative person you got to get through. There's a lot of thought and techniques to get past that person, but you definitely want to make them your friend if you can. So when we had our interview with Tucker, he discussed, you know, getting to know the secretaries and the people in there, trying to bring them gift cards, you know, $5 Starbucks cards or something like that to try to get on their good side. And that is very helpful in the cold call situation. So your success rate on that is not going to be great. You got to do a lot of them and get good at it. Cold emails are another way to do it. They don't work as well as the actual calls. And when I say calls, I mean phone calls or in person. That's what a cold call is defined as. You don't, it's not just always phone calls, but cold emails, it really only works if you have like a huge list somehow. You know, you can buy lists or find a bunch of lists. The OMMA started with their medical marijuana stuff. They had a list of all people in business, all their emails. And I sent out, I think, 15,000 emails and I got like 8 responses. So the success rate on that is even lower. So you better have a lot of emails or hit them with the cold call first and then follow up with the emails. Another form of advertising is, you know, physical advertisements, billboards, you know, bus stop ads, mailers, flyers, things like that. I've never really had much success with that in my business. We tried mailers a few times. We've tried, you know, little ads placed in bars and in billboards and stuff. It never works very well for me. Have you done any of that physical advertisements and had any success with it?
See, that's one of the things that's really hard to measure.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that a lot of people in marketing don't talk about, especially like the ones that are giving advice on the internet and stuff like that, is there's an adage in marketing. It goes something like this. It's basically 50% of my marketing budget is wasted, but I don't know which half.
Yeah. Yeah. But on the other hand, some of those gimmicks do work if they're thoughtful in their approach and the reason behind them, you know, especially if you're giving away a product that kind of goes along with what you're doing, that works out really well.
Right. And that's what I was going to say is, it's worth it to put some thought into it. Mm-hmm. It's not worth it to just gather up a bunch of crap that people don't really need.
Mm-hmm.
But if you put some thought into it and you figure out something that people will actually use,
mm-hmm.
Advertising specialties stuff, you know, still works. Pens, swag, stuff like that.
We use the pens.
Yeah, people like that. If you give them a nice gel pen or something like that feels comfortable in their hand, then that's a pen that they're going to reach for mm-hmm. a little bit more than others.
Absolutely, yeah. So all those kind of physical stuff works. And then if you do have a storefront, you're going to have some kind of, you know, physical advertisement, signs, you know, your storefront painted, things like that. The next sort of thing to talk about is radio and TV ads. Now, I've never done a TV ad, and I've done a few radio spots, but unfortunately, I didn't have the budget, nor do I have it now even, to really try to get into that market. It's very expensive, so you really need to be thoughtful in your approach if you're going to do that, and you have to spend a lot more money than you really wanted to.
Well, that's one of those things where, you know, from the guerrilla marketing book, mm-hmm. right, that says even the radio stations, right, they have like, you know, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. spots where you could do something. And just off the top of my head, right, if I were consulting you on this, I would say something like, you know, a radio spot that says something along the lines of, hey, I see you're awake, you know, at this time of night, you know, when normally most people are sleeping peacefully. Is it financial issues, you know, that got you up? You know, are you behind on your taxes? That kind of stuff, you know, and kind of that gentle pitch, you know.
Yeah, the problem for me specifically was not that we couldn't come up with something good. It's that my competitors have a much larger advertising budget, and so I have to be more thoughtful in my approach.
No, I understand that.
And I get buried in radio and TV ads.
Right, I get it. But what I'm saying is that would be one of the things where I would say, where are my competitors not advertising at?
Right.
You know, so yes, they've got the money to be on the radio during the 5 o'clock drive, for mm-hmm. example, right? And I don't.
Yeah.
So what other way can I reach some people at least, right, where I know I can get, I have a shot at getting them to listen to me?
Yeah,
Fair that's enough. What I'm saying is where you want to identify that and see how can you kind of make an end run around.
Well, that's where the gimmicky stuff comes right. in. You know, people remember that kind of stuff. So
yeah, absolutely. You know, so I'm not saying that stuff doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I'm saying it like you're saying
yeah,
it
just
is find something that really kind of resonates and is thoughtful and is not something where people just grab a free thing, a free pen or something like that that they throw away. You know, think about it like. What kind of pen do I like?
Yeah.
You know? And
the number of impressions thing you mentioned was a good topic. Cause I think it takes like 5 to 7 impressions for somebody to even remember who you are. And then I believe it's up to like 50 to actually remember like your name on site and jingle and those.
Like
kind of
if
things.
You have a slogan or something
yeah.
like that,
mm-hmm. It can take a lot of impressions. So, the last kind of thing we're going to talk about in advertising is kind of it's not optional anymore in 2024. It's the social media and digital advertising. You have got to have a web presence if you're a business in 2024. It's almost impossible to be any type of business without something, at least a website so that people can Google you and see that you're a real business. So you have to have, you know, at least a website and probably Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff. It's not 100% necessary to have all those. But you got to have something so people can at least know you're real.
So here's the thing with that that's super important for everyone. And I want everybody to remember this, okay? And I'm being dead serious right now. On social media, if you don't define yourself, other people will.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And in general, it's going to be the people who had a negative experience with you who are going to define you. And the adage goes, you know, that I got a lot of these, but the adage goes that, you know, a happy customer tells 10 people and an unhappy customer tells everyone.
Right.
So it's very, very important to stay on top of your Google listing, for example, you know, how you're listed in Google. But one of the problems there, and it's, so if you're starting a business, this is something that you have to pay attention to right away. You have to make sure that your Google listing, you own it. Everything on every platform, even if you yourself don't necessarily use it, let's take Facebook, for example, right? You should create a Facebook business page.
Mm-hmm.
And you should define it on there. You should at the very least have your contact information and a little bit about yourself. But you don't necessarily have to post there all the time, right? But what you don't want to happen is you don't want someone else to make a business page and let that define you, because people
right.
can do that.
Yeah, there are a lot of fakes out there.
So you want to be the original, you know, because at the moment that you're creating your business, no one else knows what you're doing. No one else has any reason to create something negative.
Yeah, you have to have your name on everywhere.
So
absolutely. A few tips on the website too, you know, that Wix and Squarespace, we use both. We also use the GoDaddy website builder. Those are pretty great for most people. You can just kind of build your own website, but there's no shame in hiring somebody, especially if you need something complicated. A lot of great options on Fiverr and a lot of great options of, you know, something more technical if you need that. But that should be in your advertising budget. The building of the website and maintenance of the website. So you need to make sure that you can maintain it or you have somebody that maintains it for a fee or however you want
to
know about that.
With that, I would say my advice would be, at the very, very least, you want to have what's called a static page.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it doesn't do anything other than just be informational. It's like the old yellow pages.
Yep.
But that information on there had better be correct, right? The phone number should work. The email should work. And you have to be responsive, you know? So if you get contact from those channels, respond. Because you're going to get graded on that, right? So one thing about today's world and why social media is so important is because we have a literal ratings system going on, right? So if you go on Amazon and you buy something, you're looking at the ratings, right? I can't speak for everyone, but I know myself that if I see something that is like less than 4 stars for a product, I generally won't buy it.
I also don't ever buy a product that has all 5 stars. Because if it's all five stars, I think all the reviews are fake.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's not, it doesn't matter how long you've been in business. Well, I mean, it matters how long you've been in business, but it doesn't matter how good your product is. You didn't piss one person off.
Right.
You know, just first by some accident or something. So if you don't have at least one-star review, I don't buy it.
And I will read the reviews. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll spend 2 or 3 minutes just reading the reviews and getting comfortable, yeah, right? And trying to discern, you know, like what sounds realistic, what sounds real, right? So you can kind of see it from the tone of how people talk. Mm-hmm. And it's really great. The best thing that can happen to you is when you have a real person who gives you a real honest review, and they really take the time.
Yeah.
And usually that person will also be very authentic. They will say, I love this, this, and this, but this I really didn't like. They could do this better, mm-hmm, you know? But overall, this is a fantastic product.
Yep.
And that's just honest, right? And so it gives you that feedback that you need to work on your product if you feel like it. But more importantly, it means that some other human being took the time out of their day to write up their real feelings about your product.
Yeah, and we have a whole step later in the preparation or the execution phase, sorry, phase three, about creating what's called the feedback loop and learning how to properly respond to those reviews and really take customers' concerns into mind and changing things as you go forward. So making sure you establish kind of your online presence there is very important.
So I know I'm cutting you off, but this is a subject that's kind of dear to my heart, you know, because of the way that I've gone about it. Even the way that you go about, you know, handling customers is part of your marketing.
Absolutely.
Now, I have made part of my marketing to be in my current company, for better or worse, right? There's a lot of people who will say this is a terrible idea, but part of my marketing is that I don't kiss customers' ass, you know? I don't, I have made it a rule that if a customer comes at me in a rude way, now, first of all, I will say, I will look at the issue. And if we're at fault, then I'll be contrite, I'll be sorry, right? And I'll try to make it work for them. But if they're going to come at me, even if we are at fault and they come at me as in a bullying way or a threatening way, then I'll tell them to hit the road.
Yeah, no problem and firing customers.
Absolutely.
I think we discussed that before.
Yeah.
It's not worth the aggravation.
Yeah. And the thing is that doesn't always feel good, but it comes across as authentic, you know, as long as you're in the right, you know. Now, if you're in the wrong, you should try. You should say to a customer, I require that you deal with me civilly, and I will do everything possible to solve your problem, right? I'm sorry we messed up. You know, we had a bad sewing day or you know, we missed that item. And, you know, let's talk about it and we'll figure out how to solve it. But if you're going to come at me and you're going to threaten to ruin me on social media and all this other stuff, and I've already offered to help you, then take it to social media. Let's go, you know? And I will tell them, I will say, make sure you tag me because I'm very happy to have this discussion openly. Now, what I meant by the marketing part of that, though, is this. Is when a situation like that happens, I feel like they are giving me a platform to tell the world how I would handle it if they were civil, you know? And I've got the receipts because usually I'll have the communication between us. And that has worked out very well. Although it has over the years created a number of people who absolutely cannot stand me. You know what I mean? But yeah. I take that as part of the, and sometimes though, a few times those people have followed me around for years.
Yeah. Well, if nobody hates you, then you're not doing everything right. I don't think you gotta, well, yeah, you gotta make a few enemies.
I mean,
if you're successful,
you can look at it that way for sure. But the way I started looking at it was every time they try to knock me, if you're sincere about what you're doing and you're able to stand on truth, and then what happens is that every time, this is the dynamic that's created. Every single time they try to knock me, my fans, the people that the majority, the vast majority of customers that have been serviced well, they've gotten what they wanted, beautiful transaction, you know, everything, they're really happy. they will step in and defend me, and they will defend the product, and they will defend the brand, because we've created a great number of what I would call product evangelists that are sincere, because they voted with their dollars, they paid for the product, they didn't expect anything in return, and they're happy to tell people off who are obviously just holding a grudge.
Well, to circle back to the social media stuff, a few more tips on how to do that. I'm not an expert on Instagram, but if you have a physical product that you're selling, it's almost impossible not to have some presence on Instagram. So you want to be thoughtful in kind of the posts that you're putting on there. Facebook, you had mentioned. I'm not a big user of Twitter. I'm not sure that it's 100% necessary depending on what you're doing, but if it's certainly like a social brand or something that you want to bring a bunch of people together, or you're trying to develop a community behind, Twitter is very good, especially for announcements and holidays things and specials. You know, you can throw stuff out there. There's also, you know, Reddit and Discord and a bunch of other places to get interacting with your customers. But another thing that I want to hit on too is the Hootsuite or Loomly. I just learned about Loomly. I've used Hootsuite before, but that is something that can kind of help consolidate your social media posts and help you post to a bunch of different sites all at once, and you can schedule out stuff. So those things are pretty great. Some of them can be expensive, but look into those. But now at the end of this step, we want to kind of create our budget. So we need to decide what kind of sales approach we're taking and what kind of advertising we're going to do. So again, you can call out to get quotes. You can look online. There's a lot of programs that can give you quotes, but you need to kind of put together a monthly budget is what I recommend. And so for a new company, it doesn't have to be huge, you know, $1,000 a month, even $500 a month, whatever you decide you're doing. Cold calls, you need to be thinking about your time and driving. If you have to travel, your phone bill, things like that. So just try to put together a nice little advertising budget that fits with your sales approach and your marketing strategy.
So part of that budget, as you said, is your time, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just your time as far as the cold calling and stuff. It's also your time to craft the post and mm-hmm. put them up, which is where the Hootsuite.
Yeah, all those things are great.
And all that comes in. And I'll confess, like I haven't used any of that. My approach to social media has been very sporadic, you know, like just. There's a lot of times when I make a video where I literally walk into the shop or I have an idea and I say, I'm going to go do this right now. And I just go make a video off the cuff, right? Mm-hmm. And there have been times when I've sat there and rambled for 2 or 3 hours, you know.
And I can't imagine.
And I know that there's extremely few people in the world who are going to sit through all that. But the people that do, if they sit through 30 minutes or an hour or whatever, they are now product evangelists.
There you go.
You know, so it's one of those things where you can be your own infomercial, even if you're not going to get a large audience for it, you know, where you know full well that no one's going to sit there through 3 hours. But because you're able to get things off your chest honestly about your product or about your industry or whatever, that just comes across as very passionate, very sincere, and that can be a good use of your time. Not 3 hours. Don't do that, okay? Don't make the internet your therapist.
Yeah.
You know, I've done that, and it's not great, but just remember, as you're laying all this out, don't be totally impulsive like me, you know? It is important to have a strategy and a coherence to it.
And thoughtfulness.
And a thoughtfulness to it. And as much as possible, be sincere and transparent, you know, because I think that today's world, I believe in my heart that what a lot of people value, because you can now make these personal connections, right? Whereas before, you didn't really have a lot of connection to the people who own the company, you know, especially when you're talking about selling nationally, right? Selling locally, yes, you know, you can know the plumber, right? You can know the guy doing your fence or whatever, right? But when it comes to trying to break into national sales or regional sales, the only way that people are going to get to know you is by what you say about yourself and what other people say about you. So I believe that people these days value authenticity.
Yeah.
They can smell a rat, so to speak. They can smell when you're not being real. So use the platform and be real.
Yeah. So just to sort of recap on this stage, we're just trying to develop the marketing strategy, sales approach, and advertising, and really just trying to get a budget together and make sure you at least have some kind of budget. You really want to do as much for free as possible. YouTube, those kind of things are all free, but also make sure that you have a little bit of money to play with. Otherwise, it's going to be real tough to get customers. So, any other thoughts on the marketing strategy?
I have lots of thoughts, but maybe we should save it for another podcast.
All right, fair enough. Well, the next segment we're going to talk about, and it's something that I'm excited to talk about, and I'm a little bit passionate about, is this right to repair situation. And a lot of companies argue that if they make a product, customers and other like independent repair guys should not have access to schematics, should not be able to repair stuff for you. And I think that that is absolute and utter bullshit. If you buy a product, you should have the full schematics in your hands so that you can repair it if you want to.
Or somebody should, you know, like authorized repair shops or something, mm-hmm. or whatever. But, you know, that's, I agree with you on that. I think that part of our society developing into a disposable society where we think that if something breaks, we just throw it away instead of repair it. I think that's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that has led to a lot of the pollution and the waste and just, you know, there's so many topics you could cover there, but it just in terms of time, effort, and money, it's just a colossal waste. You know, everyone's got their drawers and their attics and their storage lockers full of crap like that.
Yeah.
And we've really gotten away from
building products that
being
last.
Not necessarily building products that last, but we've gotten away from being a society that looks at something broken and says, let's figure out how to fix it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Who can I take it? Can I do this myself? Or where would I take it to? And I've seen a resurgence of that starting to come up in the last 10 years or so, where there are people online, YouTube videos and things like that, where they'll say, look, let me show you how to fix it.
Yeah.
And a website that is kind of famous for that is iFixit,
mm-hmm.
where they break things down. If the company won't provide the schematics, then iFixit will.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the pushback has come in, because you talk about like certain brands of phones, for example, famously, you know, made it very, very difficult, if not impossible, for even repair shops to be able to fix their stuff.
You know, and I'm not a big conspiracy guy, but one of the conspiracies I believe in is that your phone stops working after like a year. That they give updates and stuff that I think break your phone after about 2 years, so you have to trade it in.
Well, the question is, how would you know, right? I mean, because the code is so complicated and everything, and it's proprietary.
I think they screwed up, because at almost the 18-month mark of every single phone I've had, it stopped working as well as it did just like the day before.
It's called planned obsolescence.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Yeah, that's there. You can look it up as a term, but that's what the term is.
Mm-hmm.
And companies these days will literally plan a life cycle of a product, and they will say, this product should stop working or stop working as well after X amount of time, and that will force customers into seeking a new version of that product.
Such bullcrap. I hate that.
You know, and then you'll have people say, well, it slows down because a phone, for example, it slows down because it's got too much memory on it or it's got artifacts. And then, you know, then you have a whole industry that rises up of phone cleaner apps, for example, that you can put on your phone, which half of them turn out to be spam or malware,
mm-hmm.
you know, that actually infects your phone and makes it work even worse. Yeah. You know, so but that wouldn't even have to be a thing if the manufacturers were honest with us and said to you, we want you to be able to use this phone pretty much forever, which would be completely against their business model of selling you a new phone every 18 months.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the kind of big naysayers of the right to repair deal was John Deere for a long time. I don't know if they still do it, but that was a little bit close to us because, you know, I'm in the oil business a little bit out in Kansas, and so we have to deal with a lot of farmers. So I heard a lot of headaches, or you know, at coffee in the morning or breakfast, and of farmers just cursing the name of John Deere because their products are so computerized now. These new, you know, combines and stuff have so many computers in them that when they break down, then they won't even run. So then they have to get them trailered, you know, or towed into the dealership to get fixed. And they can't fix them themselves like they have for the last 200 years. You know, they fix their own dang products on the farm. So I thought it was kind of funny when I read an article about the Russian hackers giving them programs so that they could hack their own combines so that they could fix them.
So that is an amazing story, you know, and it's yeah. It's crazy that American farmers have to rely on Russian hackers to be able to fix their tractors, you know.
And I don't know if it's still going on, but it was for many years.
So there's two examples that come to my mind in the recent years that that have really highlighted this issue for me. One of them is Tesla. There's a channel on YouTube called Rich Rebuilds.
Yeah.
And he detailed his journey of going through like buying used Teslas that had been crashed or whatever, and basically trying to build a single working Tesla from several different ones that he had put together, and how he got stonewalled from Tesla. And at some point he got, if I remember right, and I don't know if the situation's changed now, but at some point he even got banned. Like, he cannot, in his own account, get access to Tesla superchargers, for example.
And see, that's another thing that's wild to me. They can just, with those computers, they can just stop you from using a Tesla. Like,
yeah.
You just don't get to use one.
Yeah, that's actually one of the scary things to me.
It's crazy.
You know, I remember a couple of years ago, there was a hurricane in Florida, and Elon Musk, you know, basically said, I'm sending everybody in Florida who's got a Tesla an over-the-air update to extend the range of their Tesla. So basically they own a car, it has a battery, right? So the battery could hold enough capacity to take them longer, but he wants them to pay for that, right? So in this case, he gave it to them for a little while to help them get out of the way of the hurricane.
Yeah.
But that basically puts them at the mercy of a person who can make their car work or not work, make their car work better, or not work at all on their whim, right?
That's wild.
And it is wild, right? And then on top of that, you don't have the ability to fix it yourself, you know? There's a lot of people out there who just like to tinker, for example, you know, and
well, and that guy, you said he bought one off like aftermarket,
right?
So it's not from the Tesla dealership. He buys one like that's junked and he puts it back together. He should be allowed to use it. It's his property.
And literally,
the company shouldn't have any say on whether you can use it or not.
Literally what Tesla wants in that situation. Now, I'm saying this as my opinion, you know, from basically, you know, what I might remember from watching the channel a couple of years ago. So I want to make clear that what I'm saying is not intended to be taken as pure fact, because I could be misremembering it a little bit. But the idea is that basically Tesla doesn't want their cars to be repaired. If you wreck it, they'd rather that it get, you know, dismantled and in the junkyard, rather than somebody take it and build and make a usable, workable car out of it.
Right.
And that's just insane to me.
Well, as a small business owner, you should be aware of the products that you're going to be using in your business and whether you have the right to repair them or not. And then as a consumer, I try to steer away from companies that don't allow that. So I'm a big proponent of companies that, you know, provide schematics and allow third-party people to fix them. I think those are the better products usually.
What was the story you told? Oh, I don't know if it was you or Chandler who told me this the other day, but that we discussed this. But it was like, aren't there like research scientists or something like that that have systems where they have the software that they had a machine, for example, that was set up like to measure or do something, right? And then it had software, or their software that drives it, And then the company that made the software just went out of business. So now there's zero support.
I had never thought about it until I read the article, but they called it abandonware. And right. It was just about these softwares and products and things where, you know, when they first came out, they were great, but then new products come out and new products come out, and then these things kind of get pushed away, but they're still being used by small businesses or companies, and there's no more support for them. There's no more replacement parts. There's no more updates to the software. And so these things kind of just precariously run for as long as they can. Sometimes there's a lot of research data, especially, that could be lost if something were to happen to the software or get shut down. I read once that there's like a large government agency's entire like payroll and HR system is on one small desktop computer in like the Midwest, and they can't even move it. It's under the desk and they can't even move it, because if you were to unplug it, there's a risk of losing all this data. And eventually that's going to go and it's going to cause a big problem, but there's lots of abandonware.
They must have like amazing that. Backup power sources then. I don't know. Never turn that thing off.
Yeah. There's a lot of examples of that, you know, and that was, whenever you're working with products, you need to make sure, especially as a small business owner, make sure that you're working with companies that have, you know, the right supplies and continue to update it and everything. So for example, ours, you know, I have to use QuickBooks. A lot of my clients are still on QuickBooks 15 or 16 and they stop updating those. I have to continue to use the newest software for the newest payroll and stuff like that. So I always have to make them upgrade, or I upgrade them with my accounts or whatever.
And you know, that happens with us too. We use some graphics programs, mm-hmm. And we have to continually update to the newer versions, because we deal with people who have the newer, they'll send us files in the newer versions and we can't open it in the older versions. And so we'll either have to get them to save it to an older version, if that's even possible. And you know, it's just things like this that waste so much time, and they cause so much frustration sometimes.
Oh, and that's really the killer of small businesses, is these nickel and dime things. It's usually not the big plan. It's all these little things that just eat at your bottom line or eat at your time, and you can't focus on it. It's the worst.
And it is really easy as a small business owner to look at the newest shiny thing and say, this piece of software will solve all my problems. You know, it will really help my business run. And because we are ignorant, you know, we look at the top line, we look at all the features and the benefits, right? And we don't think about what it's going to look like, you know, 3 years down the road. Is it going to be an abandonware situation? Is it going to be, you know, we don't look at like reviews, for example, of people who have used, say, QuickBooks, for example, you know, people who started with QuickBooks 5 years ago, what's their experience now?
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you that I at one time used Oracle Small Business.
Yep.
And my outlay for the Oracle Small Business was around $10,000, which represented at that time pretty much all the money I had in my bank account. But I just thought, this is what I need, because I really bought into all the features and everything.
Yeah, you probably were big on the customer portion of it, right?
Right, the CRM part and all that. And now I think it's called NetSuite, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I found out quickly, right, was that they sold it in segments, you know? Yeah. So if I really wanted to harness all the power of it, then I would have had to spend another $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. And then on top of that, you know, I'd have to upgrade every year and spend, you know, a little bit more, a little bit more. And so while the part of it that I did buy did work, I found that I had to start, you know, using other platforms to patch, you know, and do the things, because I couldn't afford to buy the whole thing.
Yep.
You know, so it should have been called Oracle Middle Business, you know, because Oracle Small Business, I don't know what they considered a small business, but I was a really small business and I was stretching just to get their bare bones package.
Yeah, that's not a great product for your size then. So, well, on the right to repair, just, you know, as a business owner, be wary of what products you're using. Mm-hmm. And I suggest that if you're creating a product, you should allow your customers to repair it. I think that adds value and it makes them happier to buy it, but I don't know.
Not only that, you should help them repair it.
Yeah.
I make videos where I tell people how to fix it. I say, you know, we'll send you a buckle, of course, if your buckle breaks, but go to Goodwill and buy a bag with a matching buckle for $2. Take the buckle off and use it, or go to your local shoe repair or your local luggage repair, and they'll open up a drawer where they've got, you know, 400 different types of buckles there, and they'll sell you one for $1.
Yeah.
You know, and I tell people this, I say, we will be happy to help you fix it. I don't want a buckle to break, but if you don't want to wait and you don't want to go fill out a form and you don't want to, you know, have to deal with all that hassle, just stop at the local luggage repair place or shoe repair place on your way home. Fix it.
Well, our next, we're going to be talking about what impressed us. And you showed me this one, which is the Burma Shave. I'd never seen it before, but that's where they had the signs on the highway, right? As you mm-hmm. kind of drive through. The closest thing I could compare it to is the Buc-ee's. You know, about every 10 miles, they have a new sign that says you're getting closer to a Buc-ee's. But tell us about the Burma Shave thing. I kind of forgot what you were talking about.
Well, the Burma Shave was basically a series of signs that would be spaced out, you know, like maybe every 5 miles or so, you know, mm-hmm. then you'd see a small sign. So it's kind of like kind of about the size of, say, yard signs, maybe a little bit bigger, but not as big as like the giant billboards we see now. And they would have like jingles on them, you know, like, you know, I can't remember one now, but it would be like limericks, you know, it'd mm-hmm. be like a little rhyme. And then let's say that it would be like 4 lines or 8 lines, right? So you'd have to go, if it's 5 miles apart, you'd have to go 50 miles to see all the 8 signs.
Yeah.
You know, and people would be looking for it, and they'd be wondering, like, what's the last line going to be and stuff. So mm-hmm. it really did, back at that time, really did put them on the map, you know, as far as impressing people, especially back then when people were more bored. Nowadays, you're driving down the highway, you know, and the only one looking outside of the car is generally the driver.
Yeah. I still think it would be interesting to see. But that's a good example of a thoughtful gimmick mm-hmm. rather than just a dumb one.
You told me about Buc-ee's. So for those of you who are watching this who don't know what a Buc-ee's is, Buc-ee's is basically a giant truck stop, auto stop, you know.
They don't allow trucks.
They don't. Yeah, they don't have trucks.
Big trucks. It's all like, I mean, you have a pickup truck, but they don't allow semis.
Right. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's all for consumers.
Come to think of it, I've never seen a semi at a Buc-ee's. Okay, so it's a giant auto stop. It's basically the biggest supersized highway gas station that you can imagine, right? And it is literally like a giant Walmart in there of gas stations. I mean, it's got every snack you can imagine. They're very famous for their bathrooms being ultra clean. Mm-hmm. We talked about this before, I think, but you literally have to work your way up to be allowed to clean the bathrooms at a Buc-ee's.
Yeah, it's like a high prestigious job to be the bathroom cleaner.
Right,
at
and it's a well paid job. Mm-hmm. So the thing that impressed me because when you live in this part of the country, Oklahoma, Texas, and so on, as you start to go towards Texas, you definitely see a lot of signs far out from a Buc-ee's, you know, several hundred miles out sometimes. But you told me one where it was like you saw a billboard in like Arizona or something, and it was
on I-40 coming east, and it was back to Oklahoma City. We're coming back, driving back from Vegas, and it was like 749 miles to Buc-ee's, and I was like, I'm not going there. It's gonna take me a day, you know.
But here's the impressive part about that, right? There are no Buc-ee's on I-40 coming east to Oklahoma City.
No.
So they're literally advertising for a Buc-ee's that's in Texas.
Yeah. I think it was the one in Denton was 749.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going that way. So.
Right. But you know, I mean, for a corporation like that, that's probably a small outlay to just maintain that billboard.
Oh, yeah. For them, it's nothing.
But can you imagine the impression it makes on people where they're like, who puts a sign out here to tell me that their thing is 800 miles away?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it stuck with you enough to remember it and tell me.
You know what? It did. And so that's kind of what impressed us this week is just those goofy road signs that really stick with you.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of things that you can think of when you're deciding what kind of advertising you want to do as a small business.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to think of those clever things. Look around, you know. I mean, take the time to really see it. Internet advertising is really, you know, interesting like that. You could make little short videos, you know, that are sort of like the Burma Shave thing where mm-hmm. where you space them out. Like you say, okay, for a 10-day period, I'm going to do one video a day, and each video is going to be something goofy that builds on you know, each day, right, to a climax.
That's a clever one.
You know, there could be all kinds of funny things, you know. One of the things I want to do with the case that I haven't gotten around to yet because I was addicted to Facebook arguing is...
No more, though.
Yeah, no more. Is I want to let my little girl take a pool cue case, put a cue inside of it, and just let her do everything she can to beat it up.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I don't care what she does. Just, you know... Like, don't cut your fingers off, obviously, trying to, like, you know, don't go grab a saw. But, I mean, every which way she can think of to abuse it, using her bare hands, I just think that would be funny.
It's a good one.
You know? And if she manages to break it, then maybe I don't put it up. No, I'm kidding. But no, maybe I would put it up. Because what I want is I want to say, this is what it takes to break a case, right? So if you don't intend on letting your child take out her anger on your case, then it's probably going to last you forever. So I think that would possibly be clever, depending on how it's done. But that is something that doesn't even take that much planning and can be funny,
yeah.
You know? And if you want to spend a little bit more, if we wanted to get somebody like Calvin, for example, who knows his way around editing and everything like that, then it could be even cooler, right? And these days, actually, on the phone, there's so many apps and so many ways that you can mash up things. I saw a really clever ad the other day where I don't know if you've seen this meme, but it's a like a SUV is driving down the beach in like Saudi Arabia or something, and the SUV is like, you know, coming at a high rate of speed. And then the guy that's kind of watching gets out of the way. And then the SUV flips and the driver is ejected into the water. And then the driver basically swims away from it. He gets up out of the water and kind of, you know, walks out. And his car is like, you know, kind of halfway in the ocean right there. So nobody gets hurt. You know, he got maybe got a little, I think if I remember right, he had a little limp. But what was really clever was somebody took that video and they made a mashup out of it where as soon as you see the guy flip out of it, then you see a guy come up out of the water with a bucket, right? And he goes, "Don't worry about how we catch them. Just come to the restaurant and enjoy them." And it's a crab shack.
Yeah, that's pretty clever.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's just that restaurant, you know, somebody there. Thought,
clever idea.
Yeah, let's just use this and boom, boom, boom. It probably didn't take him that much effort to make that ad and put it up. And it didn't cost him anything other than doing the editing and throwing it up on the internet.
Well, there you go. That's a clever one. That's what impressed us as well this week. Okay. Well, any final thoughts for this week?
No, I really don't. Yeah, I don't have any other thoughts, so I'm sorry.
All right, well, you can always
catch I thought I might have something clever to say, but, you know, I don't. I'm not always funny.
There you go. Well, you can catch us at turtlesmith.com. We'll see you next week.
All right, you guys take care. Bye-bye.